I'm Scott Buchapman. I teach film studies in the Department of Art and Art History here at Stanford.
Well, Scott, we're talking to you about your interest in superheroes and the way that superheroes appear in your work and maybe in your life as well. But what are your first memories of reading superhero comic books?
Oh, I mean, I've read them my whole life, I suppose. I mean, I remember reading Spider-Man and the Fantastic Four, especially when I was growing up. I was definitely a Marvel kid. I was buying multiple copies and, you know, books that were just tangentially related to other books. But I liked the whole Marvel Universe thing with the interacting heroes. I enjoyed it a lot. And luckily, as I was growing up, superhero comics were sort of growing up too, getting more sophisticated in their writing, in their art, in the treatment of the characters. So with some brief breaks here and there, I kept reading them off and on. And at the moment, there's such an explosion of incredible comics material, not just superhero comics, but comics of every stripe. I think it's the most exciting medium going right now. And among the things where there's good work being done, there's superhero comics.
And when you were growing up, what did those stories mean to you?
I liked the dynamism of them. I mean, I think I enjoyed reading Spider-Man because I liked the character of Spider-Man and Peter Parker and that whole world that was there. But I found that I didn't really go back and reread those as much as I would go back and reread the Fantastic Four comics by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. And certainly, I was very interested in the artists at that time. There weren't that many different writers. And other than Stan Lee, the writing was pretty interchangeable from one writer to another. But Kirby's artwork just leapt out at me, and I found it incredibly exciting and cosmic. It had big ideas going, and I think that pretty much fed into a fondness for science fiction that came about, you know, in my teenage years. I think Fantastic Four fed right into Stanley Kubrick. And I don't want to date myself too badly, but it's around the time that I got out of college that this explosion of more interesting comics material started to happen in the late 70s and early 80s, and that was a really opportune moment to start buying in again. And I was never, you know, buying truckloads of the things. I guess maybe at some points in my life I was, but mostly I was being pretty selective. But there was a lot to choose from then. I went to Brown University back when they had a major in something called semiotics, and it was the science of signs and meaning, and it was very, very highfalutin, and I managed to convince my parents that it was the coming thing, that it was important. Semiotics probably allowed me to take things that I liked seriously. At the time, Umberto Eco was writing a lot of literary theory, and he was happily writing about Superman and James Bond and Batman versus James Joyce's Ulysses, and which was an open text and which was closed, and providing all these hilarious, counterintuitive ways of understanding what we call popular culture and taking it seriously. And I think that had a real impact on me, actually. Even if I didn't use the methodology of semiotics, it certainly became evident to me that anything could be potentially as interesting as anything else. What I try to do in writing about superheroes or anything like that is I try not to, and this goes back to my rejection of semiotics as a kind of model, I try not to make what I'm dealing with overly serious. In other words, I don't want to justify my relation to superhero comics by finding deep meanings that somehow make it all okay that we can study them and that they're legitimate objects of discourse. I sort of want to get at the fascination that I felt then and feel now, which may, in fact, in the case of something like superheroes, lie in how unserious they are. So can you write seriously about something while still regarding it as unserious, as frivolous, as playful? And can you somehow match that in your own writing? And I think that's been a more productive approach than trying to find the deeper meanings in superheroes and find Oedipal conflicts and trauma and guilt and all the things that are weighing down superhero films these days. I prefer to go for the sort of weightlessness of Superman and the sort of joy of that kind of character as opposed to the adult trauma that they suffer from. I think it would be fun to be a superhero. I don't know.
Ticket.
When I left New York after my doctorate and got a job in Albuquerque, New Mexico, I became really obsessed with cities. And what I sort of realized was that superheroes almost all lived in cities. And I was wondering why. There was a dumb answer to that, which was criminals are in the cities. But, you know, superheroes can travel real fast. They got the Batmobile. They can fly. They're the Flash, whatever. And they don't have to be that close to the crime. So that maybe there was something else. And I started thinking about superheroes as sort of fundamental urban types. First of all, superheroes have dual identities. Where but in a large city could you get away with having a dual identity? I mean, Superboy comics are bending over backwards to, like, give Superboy these robots to fool everybody so that he can, you know, be in two places at once. But, you know, Superman didn't need robots. You know, it was a big city. He could duck into a closet here and appear as Superman there, and, you know, nobody would, except Lois for 40 years, you know, would wonder about, you know, where Clark was all that time. So there was a way in which, just like in musicals where you would go out there a youngster and come back a star, you could come to the city and become someone, someone public, someone flamboyant, someone performative, all those things that cities inculcate. You know, Georg Simmel, in an essay he wrote in the early part of the century called The Metropolis and Mental Life, said, the city is bad because everybody is reduced to a function and a number and anonymity. But on the other hand, the city is also the place where you can really stand out, where you can really, people would come from a small town, as Superman did, come from a small town to the city to become something, to remake yourself. And the city was all about that. And it struck me this was absolutely the archetype of the superhero narrative. So again and again, I just started seeing that, and I concentrated on three, Superman, Batman, and Spider-Man, as not only all being urban denizens, but of having three different relationships to the city. Superman looked at the city from above and with X-ray vision, so there was a sense of mastery and transparency and openness and democracy despite the surveillance, a kind of openness about the surveillance, so a kind of democratic Superman. You had Batman in the Batcave underneath and knowing the catacombs with his computers and his maps and his technology, sort of understanding the city from below. And you had Spider-Man, the teenager, swinging around the city on a web and clinging to buildings with his fingers, a very tactile relationship, a very sensual, you know, his spider sense, a very sensual relationship to the city. But nevertheless, these were three ways of knowing the city, three paradigms of urban knowledge that were, you know, incarnated by these guys. So I was really sort of taken by how, you know, how much superheroes and cities went together. I would pull a lot of pictures down, you know, from online sources and look at them. And again, I just kept seeing, you know, Batman in Gotham City in all kinds of interesting ways and Superman in Metropolis in all kinds of interesting ways. And this was a really recurring motif. And again, as I said, I had left New York. I had New York on the brain and was missing New York. And here was, you know, something that was fundamentally New York to me growing up was were the Marvel comics, which were all set in New York. I mean, Batman, you know, was Gotham City, which was really New York, and Superman was in Metropolis, which was really New York, but a different New York. But, you know, all the Marvel characters lived in New York. They were my neighbors, essentially. They even had neighborhoods. I mean, I knew where they lived. So there was a way in which that was certainly re-tapping into a sort of, you know, fondness of mine. But I'd also been, you know, writing these essays about Blade Runner, about musicals. I'd been teaching a course, which I still do, called Cinema and the City, and thinking about urban representation and the ways in which, you know, the city is figured in different media. And that was all sort of informing my looking at these and discovering that, here's a major text. I mean, here's a major urban text that no one's really discussed before. So I think it was somehow generated by nostalgia as some sort of initial impetus, but then a sort of logical conclusion of the work I'd been doing, reading and writing about cities, and so a kind of cultural history that was emerging out of that.
So
certainly when I was younger, I did feel that there were more. There was more of a sense of possibility of what selves I would turn out to be. Now I seem to be sort of stuck with the identity that crept up on me over the years. But you know, back then it was who knows what I could be. So there is that sense of perhaps a desire for multiple identities, a desire for a recognition that we are different people to different people at different times. And superheroes make that explicit. But still, I think there was more of a sense of the possibility, and especially when you're a child, that you could be this and that. Choices didn't have to be made, you know. Very appealing fantasy now that I think about it. I think the revival of the superhero film has more to do with special effects. I think it can be summed up in three letters, CGI. Computer-generated effects allow this passage from a prosaic human body to a super body that doesn't obey normal laws of physics. It can bounce off walls. It can fly. It can melt through materials. It can turn on fire. It can turn into ice, whatever. It can grow claws, you know, things that would be very difficult to do with mechanical effects or optical effects can now be done frighteningly easy with, you know, the proper computers. So the fact that it could be done, I think, is one reason why they've proliferated. I mean, the special effects made it possible. But I think also, I think there's a potentially interesting way to understand it. If you think about special effects, I've written a lot about special effects, mostly of the earlier pre-digital variety, that special effects were a way of envisioning future landscapes, future cities, of helping you think about the future. Was there a way, or is there a way, that the digital body in the superhero film, is there a way that that becomes a way of thinking about our bodies in digital culture, in a culture that, you know, in which we live on Second Life, in which we navigate by GPS systems, in which the overlay of physical and virtual spaces is, you know, ever more complete and ever easier for us? Is there a way that the superhero who switches between human and digital bodies, you know, embodies some of that anxiety about what the physical body is in a digital world? If you think about it, the forerunner of Spider-Man in you know, a digital incarnation is not Terminator Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's the liquid metal Terminator in the second film, who's done with digital technology, and he morphs into whatever shape he wants and is very fluid. And people have written about that extensively. I have too. But that really is the basis of the superhero body, going from, you know, Tobey Maguire to this little CGI rubberoid figure, you know, swinging through New York. What's interesting to me is that much as I like the weightlessness of superheroes, there's a way in which I find the superhero movies to be on some level too weightless. And I think it's because there is not a real body at the center of it. Musicals presented Fred Astaire dancing up the wall and dancing on the ceiling. But that was done with an in-camera special effect. It's a real body in a real space. When Kubrick had somebody walk up a wall and onto a ceiling in 2001, same trick exactly. Westerns have characters, you know, climbing up walls, but gravity is pulling them down and they have to strain to do it. Spider-Man 2, Spider-Man and Doc Ock zip up and down walls as though they're, you know, careening down a corridor on an office chair or something. They're just blithely, you know, sailing along. There's a way in which, you know, there's not enough, and this is going to sound really weird, but there's not enough pain. There's not enough physical strain. There's not a sense of a body doing something. And I kind of think that might be why the stories are so loaded down with extraneous weight. Let's add more villains. Let's give him an ultra traumatic origin story. I mean, let's make him miserable. Let's, you know, invoke the Patriot Act. I mean, there's a way in which, you know, the superhero film, by virtue of its special effects, is so weightless as to be almost literally meaningless. And so there's a kind of artificial weight that's put on them, like ballast, you know, to sort of weigh them down to the ground by freighting them with, you know, a lot of narrative trauma and stress. It used to be, way back when, well before my time, you know, superheroes were invented because they were a way of taking advantage of the cheap color printing that they could use to make the comic book. So you had slabs of yellow and red and brightly colored costumes. Now comics are colored digitally, drawn digitally in many cases. So one can say actually that the superhero in comics and in film is a digital incarnation any way you want to look at it. But there is a way in which there's still something suitable, and there's something about the comic book which retains a kind of handmade sensibility, even though, you know, it has moved to digital production on all levels. There still is, you know, an artist there, you know, drawing something. There is still a writer working with a script. And somehow those things are available to you directly in the comic book that you hold, not filtered through, you know, a million sensibilities between there and the finished product in the film. I don't want to denigrate film by any means, and I don't even want to denigrate blockbuster films in any way, but I just have not, you know, I just have not found them very compelling. And everybody really wants me to write about superhero films, but I keep coming up against the idea of, but I don't really like them.
The most important question that I want to end with is, A, what is your superpower? And then B, what is your kryptonite?
Yeah, I have to say, as the guy who wrote this book, Matters of Gravity, which was all about weightlessness, that I would have to go for the classic boy superpower of flying. There is just something about that that, you know, seems to be at the core of my attraction to many of the things that I wrote about in the book Matters of Gravity, musicals and superhero films. And I find – not superhero films, sorry, superhero comics. But I find musicals and superheroes actually strangely similar, and special effects and science fiction. There's a way in which, you know, the defiance of gravity really, really appeals to me and really makes me want to, you know, emulate that in my writing, to try to write something that is not heavy but which has, you know – but which has weight. So that's the sort of paradox. And what would my kryptonite be? I would like to say kryptonite. That would be cool. I would say that, you know, weight is my enemy. Yeah, on some level, you know, weightiness is my enemy, which is why, you know, being at Stanford has been a kind of, you know, pleasurable struggle, you know, because this is a very, very weighty institution, and I try to float as best I can.
Is Umberto Eco your arch nemesis?
Eco's my arch nemesis because he wrote about everything good way before I got there. I mean, really, the nemesis of any academic is the people who are writing about what really interests you before you get to it. Anxieties of influence.
Well, thank you, Scott.
Sure. Thank you, Lee.
Lee Constantino is a PhD student in the English department at Stanford, and the fiction editor for the Storytelling Project.